Hello kids, just a quick one from me this week. As ever, myself and Barry would like to rain down the warm nectar of benevolence and munificence upon your collective countenances for supporting this podcast via listening, talking about it, retweeting it, and of course, via donating to us on our Patreon page. We've asked an old pal of mine, Mark Burrows, on the show this week to talk about the world's worst invasions, and he's also a guest on the show because he's got a book to plug. More of that you will hear in the episode. Talking of books, myself and Barry would very much like to write a book ourselves, a compendium of our favourite world's worsts from the show. February the 30th in Sweden in 1712, Her Majesty's pornographers, Carlos Kaiser, all sorts of daft stories like that, and perhaps some ones that didn't make the final cut. And it just so happens, he says, armed with his enormous crowbar, that is the next goal on our Patreon page. We're just five away. If five more of you donate to us from as little as $2 a month, then that is going to be the starting pistol for me and Barry to really knuckle down and gather together all our favourite stories and start putting them into some sort of book format. And if you look out the window at the state of the world right now, well, actually, it looks quite nice if you just take the look out your window. But, you know, if you look at the news, I think the world is ready for a compendium of humanity's heroic failures. So, yeah, that's what we want to do. And as you probably know, if you've listened to this quite a lot, we are reasonably generous with what happens on Patreon. If you chuck us $3 a month, you get all sorts of excellent freebies and offcuts and treasure hunts that we've done recently. Chuck us a fiver a month, you can suggest a topic for a show. $10, you can come be a judge, and $20 a month, just like last week, you can join the likes of Seif, Sarah and Thomas Vash and become guests on the show. Or you can be like our pal Dash, chuck us $20 a month and go, my voice is not one that should be broadcast. Either way, it's the sort of thing that will enable me and Barry to have the time to research things properly and write and then approach publishers and designers and all sorts of things like that. We're really excited to get this sort of thing going. And also, speaking as a pair of performers, it'd be lovely to have a project that is not reliant on a physical audience in the room with us for us to get our teeth into. So if you want to hold in your hand a cold, hard copy of a Worst Foot Forward book and then perhaps slip it into the stocking of a loved one, then this is your chance. If you're not able to contribute to us monetarily, but you want to help us out, totally grand. You can do that, as ever, by chucking us a cheeky little review, preferably on iTunes or one of the major podcatchers. 5 stars, a few nice words. It really helps to tickle the algorithms and make us more visible. If you want to get in touch with us, I'm on at Ben Vanderveld. He's on at Baz McStay. The podcast is on at Worst Foot. And you can catch both of us at the same time by emailing worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Normally at this stage I'd be promoting what I'm doing online this week, but I'm taking a week off to recharge my batteries, but I'll be back on Wednesday, June the 24th with my pub quiz, this week in aid of LGBT Switchboard, a brilliant LGBTQ plus charity. And we've already had some of you guys tune into my quiz this week. We raised money for Black Lives Matter's Legal Defence Fund and raised almost £400. And there was, I think, 3 or 4 at least listeners of the podcast and Patreon contributors. So if you enjoy the trivia that I bring to this podcast as a springboard for funny, come and find out what sort of trivia I bring along when I want to stick corkscrews in your brain as a quiz master. I'm also back on the Monday before that, the 22nd of June, with HMS Unprecedented, my live streamed comedy show, which is on Twitch and Facebook Live for Good Ship Comedy. Oh, my quiz is on my Facebook Live page for Ben Vanderveld, and Twitch is Furry Four Footer, and Barry's doing his National E-Theatre Jazz on YouTube. I think we can all agree that this has been some rather slapdash ramshackle admin. And talking of things that are slapdash and ramshackle, it's time to find out about some truly moronic invasions. Charge!
Hello.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me mustering our troops on the border as we prepare to unleash our fearsome trebuchets. However, due to a navigational error, it's the borders of the geranium garden at the Chelsea Flower Show, and we're about to commit some deeply irresponsible herbicide. Still, if that's the worst mass culling that happens this week, given the current circumstances, we'll all be relieved. And with me is the unexpected invasion to my bleak Russian winter, Barry McStay.
You're right.
I'm feeling pretty good, Barry, considering that this is being recorded precisely 7 days after the last episode and not 15 minutes afterwards.
Yes, we're definitely not still just the day after Trump gassed Americans.
I think we need to copyright that joke format to Richard Herring.
Yeah. You're definitely all better than last week's audience.
You're definitely all better than last week's news headlines.
Yeah. Have you ever suffered an invasion, a home invasion, or an infestation of bugs or anything like that?
The worst I've had, I was thinking about this, I've not had an infestation of bugs, but the worst was when I was in drama school, and in second year, I got to play Iago, and how can I put it politely? There's a part that gets in your head, and Iago... not a happy wee man, and my girlfriend at the time's house, it backed onto like some swampland in New Cross, and in the middle of high summer when we were doing it, I woke up the next morning with like 31 welts on my back from some sort of beast from the swamp that had come in and eaten me, and it was so painful. But being the incredibly pretentious acting student I was at the time, after a couple of days I was like, yeah, my Iago is a malformed beast. And that's why he's so angry. And so I was deliberately like scratching all of the itches from the infestation to really get into character as this sort of hellish creature.
Our guest this week is a musician, comedian, journalist and author. Rearrange those jobs in whatever order of importance you desire. He's the editor of I Think I Can See Where You're Going Wrong and other wise and witty comments from Guardian readers, which is a very long book title. In it, they collated insights from readers of the newspaper formerly called the Manchester Guardian and currently called the Liberal Metropolitan Elite Guardian. And it includes such gems as airline employees were so much more agreeable back when they were all drunk, and dishwashers make lousy salmon poachers. He's also the author of the upcoming release, The Magic of Terry Pratchett, the first full biography of Sir Terry Pratchett ever written, available from all good libraries so long as they are taken out in silence, returned no later than the date shown, and you don't meddle with the nature of causality while there. He's also the bass player in the anachronistic punk band The Men That Will Not Be Blamed For Nothing, alongside friend of the show Andrew O'Neill. So, here to be blamed for literally everything we can think of, it's Mark Burrows.
Hooray! Hello. Thank you for not saying steampunk.
I make a rule of never saying steampunk.
Yeah, I tried to make that rule as well, but unfortunately it keeps creeping in.
You've got a cog motif on your glasses. How wonderfully wacky of you. Fuck off, steampunk enthusiasts.
10 years I've been in this band. 10 years.
Just. Yeah. Steampunk can get the same...
I've seen in this last decade.
Steampunk can get in the same sea as LARPing, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the thing is, if you say steampunk in the mirror 3 times in a row, then a mechanical version of Queen Victoria turns up.
And then she stands at a sort of socially awkward distance from you and doesn't really say anything. eventually she goes away because you've made it quite clear that you're ignoring her. That's just my experience of steampunk conventions. The band is a Victorian-based punk band, and we did unfortunately lean rather into the word steampunk in our first few years, and then quickly abandoned it, but by then it was too late, and it's followed us around like a yappy dog ever since.
Wearing flying goggles and a long leather coat. Yeah, cool
and
dog.
Tiny little top hats that's built onto a fascinator.
Yeah. You've got a cane with a skull on it. Ooh, how clever.
Yeah, I'd love to take you to the Steampunk World's Fair in New Jersey and just see what you make of the whole thing.
Steampunk, you've all got magnificent pistols. Well, I've brought a shotgun.
You just want to turn up and just like, good day, my name's Barry and I, sir, have a personality.
Yeah. Let me introduce you to computing.
Yeah.
Not Charles Babbage, you wanker. Fuck off.
Actually, a lot of steampunks know a lot about computing.
Yeah.
Most of them very rarely leave their homes.
Yeah. I didn't realise steampunk was really such a go button for me. I'm just... Maybe it's been locked up for so long that...
You should join our band. You'd fit right in.
Yeah.
Most of our rehearsals sound like this.
Yeah.
This is beautiful. It feels like anyone, whether it's musicians or comedians or stage actors, you know that you're a true professional when you've reached the stage of loathing your fans.
Yeah. Oh, God, we're alienating so many listeners.
Yeah.
I love our fans. Our fans are brilliant. It's just, you know... Some of them have questionable social skills. To be honest, a lot of our fans just see us as a kind of quirky version of a punk band and aren't really in it for the... And aren't really in it... Like, they didn't come to it through the Victorian stuff. They came to it through the punk stuff and then liked the Victorian angle. And increasingly, I think that side of it has overtaken the other side now.
How does one come to be a Victorian punk? Is it like putting, like, horns on the front of your penny farthing? What's the...
First of all, you befriend Andrew O'Neill on the stand-up circuit.
Yeah.
That's the first, and then get drunk with him at the Edinburgh Festival and talk about how you play bass whilst he's considering forming a band. That is basically how it happened to me. I mean, the Victorian version of we used to dress up a lot more. That's been dialed down a bit now. And now there's kind of just a Victorian kind of angle to our looks. Like, you know, it's sort of... like I tend to wear band t-shirts under a suit jacket, for example. That's like we used to be a lot more into it. Our singer does a lot more; it's a lot more theatrical. But mostly, it's about what the songs are about, as opposed to what we look like or right. anything like that. And it's not like Cogs and Goggles; it's like Victorian social criticism and weird, twisted stories about somebody about chimney sweeps being burned out of chimneys. And houses and haunted houses and
I mean these sound like policies from the latest Tory convention.
Yeah.
It gets noticed a lot though. Like over the years, the thinly disguised social satire of our music has become thinner and thinner and thinner. Like particularly when austerity really kicked in, and it was like you could draw so many parallels to the Victorian era that it was almost lazy. It was so obvious to do. But our last album was just seethingly angry. Like, there's a song on it called Obscene Fucking Machine that may as well... That's about Queen Victoria's oldest son, Prince Bertie. But it may as well be about Boris Johnson.
Trying really hard to rhyme Gladstone with George Osborne.
Stretching. We don't mention the present day. That's exactly.
Oh, that makes sense. I mean, I was just going to say, like, Disraeli rhymes beautifully with ukulele.
I don't know what's
ukuleles are another thing that can fuck off and is banned from anything to do with our band.
This should be the new version of the podcast. We don't ask people like about really serious things. What are your pet hates? Oh wait, no, we're just doing Room 101 now.
Yeah. We know clearly that you're a talented bassist, journalist and chronicler of Sir Terry, more of which I'm sure soon. But what, Mark, are you worst at?
Sport. I'm the worst at all sports, all of them. I've yet to find a sport I can do. I'm quite good at rollerblading, except I've got quite flat feet, so it hurts after 10 minutes and I have to stop. And that is literally the extent of my sporting ability. I'm terrible at all forms of sport. I am the kid that when playing cricket fielded as far out as possible to make sure that there was no chance the ball would come with them and when it come near them. And when it did come near them, it hit them in the face because they were daydreaming. I am awful at all of the sport.
So I'm not great at catching. And when I played cricket, I used to try and be really close in because there would usually be an excuse for not catching it. Oh, the ball was going past me too fast. Whereas if you're really far out on like the boundary, and the ball is like skied up into the air, there's so long for everyone to turn and look at you and prepare the disappointed faces when you inevitably let the ball slip through your fingers.
My least favourite thing was left-handed batsmen, because I would deliberately make sure that I was on the left-hand side of most batsmen, because most of them are right-handed, I'd probably be all right. But everyone's probably you get a fucking left-hander, and they're all like, ugh, and they'd probably spotted that I was a weak link.
Yeah, it does feel sometimes when a batsman is that good and they can whack at the same place every time, you're like, I've spotted the rollerblader with the flat feet. I know who to aim for.
I'm surprised cricket's not making more of a comeback list at the minute, because it's a very socially distant sport.
Yeah, golf is back in. My dad went golfing for the My dad is in his early 70s. He probably won't appreciate me saying that, but he went back to play golf yesterday for the first time since lockdown started. And they have, I don't know if this is what it's going to be in all golf courses there. You're not, if the ball is in the bunker, you take it out and you drop it because they don't have to use rakes then. You don't pull the flag out. They've got a little like disc, which is about an inch below the hole. So the ball isn't down in the hole. It just sort of drops into this thing. You can pull it back out again real easy. It's sort of sitting on this disc rather than down in the hole.
Like a quite diaphragm. Clever.
Like a diaphragm, yeah.
Yeah.
And in Ireland, that's what passes for sex education, so, you know. Yeah. The Italian invasion of Egypt in 1940 was Mussolini's Italians a fine victory. They, you know, moved about 12 miles a day over the course of a week in September 1940. But as they moved along, they basically occupied a series of fortified camps, like a string of camps, not terribly close together. And so the British, when they decided to launch their counterattack during Operation Compass, they basically planned a 5-day raid to just push the Italians back a bit. But they decided after the first couple of attacks that maybe they'll be prepared to push even further rather than just drive the Italians back a bit. If we're making a lot of ground, let's really go for it. And the British made really fast progress because the Italians had strung themselves out at these series of camps. They'd basically like lined up like dominoes for the British to attack. So you had 36,000 British soldiers who, over the course of 2 months, from December 9th of 1940 to February 9th, 1941, they lost 36,000 of them. They lost less than 600 troops while inflicting 5,000 kills on the Italians and capturing 125,000 Italian soldiers, 420 tanks, 564 aircraft, and the port of Tobruk. So as invasions go, Italy's invasion where they took Egypt and then went, okay, now let's make sure we're all too far away from each other to help each other when the counterattack comes, is pretty poor. The famous failed invasion in World War II is the German advance into the Soviet Union. Stalingrad and all of that.
I mean, I was about to say, far be it for me to quote great comedy heroes, but again, Sir Terry's turning up later. I love Eddie Izzard talking about the invasions of Russia of Napoleon going, I've got a good idea. Oh, it's a bit cold. and then Hitler going, I've got a better idea. It's the same idea.
Everyone says Siege of Stalingrad in terms of, in comedy terms, I always just think of Alexei Sale.
Yes.
Young one. Siege of Stalingrad. Just shouting communist buzzwords.
Well, the Germans, in fairness, had their own buzzwords. They basically assumed that the Soviets and the Slavs were racially inferior to them. And part of the reason they thought, oh, let's just invade the Soviet Union, is they assumed they would fall apart at the first sight of the Germans. As one of the articles I read said, racism and hope are not viable strategies. So the Soviets followed, you know, Stalin's order to order number 227, not one step back. They made the Germans fight for every inch. And for 6 months, the Germans were trying to besiege Stalingrad, taking it street by street and house by house. They threw 1 million men at the city and lost over 800,000 of them. The Soviets lost 1.1 million, but they bled the German supply lines so dry that eventually Germany had to have to turn back. Have you heard of Pavlov's house?
No.
I didn't know this. I mean, I'm sure there are many stories like this, but this is one of the more famous instance from the Siege of Stalingrad. It was Pavlov's house. It was an infantry platoon there, about 30 to 50 men, under the command of a guy called Sergeant Yakov Pavlov. And they turned it into this apartment building into a fortress. And they occupied this in September, and they were there for nearly 60 days until they were relieved. And they just set up there with, you know, barbed wire around it. They set mines. They had machine gun posts at every single window facing into the square. And they had an anti-tank rifle on the roof of the building, which was particularly useful for ambushing unsuspecting German tanks, because once they came within range of the building, they had the roof of the tank was exposed to the location of the anti-tank gun, and the anti-tank gun was too high up for the tank's weapons to point up at it.
The other good thing about Pavlov's house, though, is that every time you rang the doorbell, a boxing glove would come out and hit you in the face. But every time you went around the back door and knocked, somebody would give you a sweet. And eventually, people were trained to just go to the back door.
The building...
The Halcyon response.
Yeah. the building is still there. It was rebuilt afterwards. It still uses an apartment building, and there's a memorial sort of built onto the wall of the modern building made of bricks from the original building picked up after the battle. I also read about Julian, Emperor, the Roman Emperor Julian the Apostate. He's maybe most famous for being the last non-Christian emperor of Rome. He tried to turn Rome back to paganism.
Oh, he's after Constantine?
Yeah, yeah. He tried to turn things back. He was emperor in the 350s and 360s. And he decided to wage a war in Persia, which the Wikipedia notes was the last undertaking of the Roman Emperor Julian was the Perso-Russian War. I've got a to-do list and I'm finishing with the Perso-Russian War. He basically decided he wanted to conquer the Sasanian Empire under Shapur II. And... It started really well. It was taking all the palaces and the gardens of the monarchy of Persia north of Ctesiphon, which was their capital. And he dug, very cleverly, dug a canal between the Euphrates and the Tigris to allow his fleet to get from the Euphrates to the Tigris to bring supplies even further into Persia and to supply the army for the siege of Ctesiphon, which he was preparing for. And he brought all these amazing siege engines and weapons and had this fleet and big army with them, but they just had a lot of difficulty getting the city under siege. I don't know whether it was an organizational thing. They couldn't make it happen. They'd actually conquered the city several times, like down through the generations, but this time round it was much better fortified. And deciding it was too difficult to try and capture the city, he decided, let's not capture the city. Let's march further into Persia's interior and take the cities further in and, you know, drain the supplies to and drained the morale of the Persians. And so in doing that, he decided the best thing to do after abandoning the siege would be to burn his fleet of ships and all of their provisions to stop them falling into the Sasanian hands.
That seems a little rash.
He kept 20 days worth of supplies to march inland, thinking, oh, we're marching into, you know, the breadbasket, there's going to be lots of lush, fertile land further in. We'll be able to use the crops there. And naturally, Shapur II's army just went, scorched earth policy it is then. And the Roman march just got hotter and hotter and they were driven into starvation. And they were eventually ambushed. They were so hot. In fact, at the time they were ambushed, Julian wasn't even wearing his helmet or armor. And so he was killed in battle, or injured in battle, mortally injured in battle, because he still didn't have time to stick it back on him in time for the fight that he was involved in. And it led to a Christian general of his, Jovian, taking over, immediately reinstating Christianity and signing a really embarrassing peace deal, where they not only gave back all the land they'd taken, but some of their previous holdings as well, back to the Persians. But I stuck with World War II for my choice, and I have decided to talk about Operation Cottage, which we have talked about briefly on the show before, Ben.
Okay.
We're going to Alaska, to the Aleutian Islands, and the Japanese forces had held Kiska Island since June 1942, and so that's about a year by the time we come to Operation Cottage. The Japanese taking Kiska and the other island in the Aleutians, Attu, was a big psychological blow to the Americans because no enemy force had occupied any North American territory since the War of 1812. So here were the Japanese off the coast of Alaska with, being able to build... They were building air bases and they had taken over a US weather station and a radar station, all these things. And so that really dented the morale of the American public. And so they create the Alaska Defense Command, a force of 24,000 people under the command of Major General Simon Bolivar Buckner Jr. They were set out to try and defend the Aleutians and take it over. And Kiska was the better island, if you like. They had a fully developed harbor and an airfield and a larger garrison than on Attu. But they decided to take back Attu first, and it was a really bloody battle, the Japanese basically retreated to the upper inland areas of the island, left loads of booby traps around the coast, which the Americans had to fight their way through, and then fight battles against the Japanese on who were on higher ground. And it was really, really... And the Japanese nearly broke through the lines and retook it. It was a really bloody battle. And at the end of it all, I think there were, you know, only 29 Japanese left from the 2,500 that had been on the island. The Americans had fought with 16,000 troops and lost nearly 4,000... had nearly 4,000 casualties. And so... when they learned from that, okay, the Japanese really know how to put up a fight, we won't make the same mistake at Kiska. So they spent the month of July 1943 with the 11th Air Force dropping 424 tons of ordnance on Kiska. US Navy cruisers and destroyers were lobbing an additional 330 tons of shells onto, like, bombarding the place. Air reconnaissance operations, collecting intelligence, because there was a lot of fog in the area, so they didn't want to, you know, make any of the same mistakes they'd made at Atta. They could gather this landing force of Americans and some Canadians. And when the routine activities on Kiska seemed to drop off, you know, there weren't bomb... buildings weren't being rebuilt and craters weren't being repaired and didn't seem there was as much anti-aircraft fire as they had had, and radio signals dropped off completely on the 28th of July. There was some suspicions. But Admiral Tom Kincaid, who was the head of the whole thing, said, "Yeah, the Japanese haven't escaped. They've decided to retreat inland and lie in wait for us, just like at Attu. Okay, we just have to be careful. We have to be very careful. We don't need to send extra reconnaissance. Don't need to send a scouting party. It's risky. It's unnecessary. They're just following the same textbook." So on August 15th, 1943, the US 7th Infantry and the 13th Infantry Brigade from Canada landed on opposite shores on Kiska. Can you see where this is going?
Yeah.
they deployed the first special forces force, the first special service force, an elite special forces unit of American and Canadian commandos. They began their climb. There was artillery fire all around them. The warships were still bombarding the higher land over their heads. Rumors of casualty and firefights and booby traps went up. There were booby traps and time bombs and accidental ammo explosions because people were getting nervous in the fog. There were some friendly fire incidents. And when they eventually realised that the entire island had been left uninhabited by the Japanese for a good couple of weeks at this point, one of the American ships in the harbour had struck a mine, leaving the Allied forces with 92 fatalities and 221 people wounded in an effort to take an unabandoned island. Apparently, on the evening of July 28th, a small task force of cruisers and destroyers had slipped through the Allied naval blockade, extracted 5,000 Japanese troops in less than an hour, and then gotten back out again, left a small rear guard who were, you know, still firing some anti-aircraft guns, and they were later evacuated by submarine. Which, it's not only a disaster for the Allies, but it's also a brilliant, daring evacuation manoeuvre by the Japanese.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, for in all the ways that the evasion was terrible, yeah, the evacuation balanced it out by being brilliant.
Yeah. So, hampered by booby traps and not knowing who they were shooting at in the fog.
What a stupid waste of time.
Absolutely. But an article I read about was very good at sort of saying how these were people who had just... they thought they had learnt from the previous invasion of Attu. Rather than going, every situation is unique, they'd gone, this is exactly the same as the last time. And they had come into it with assumptions about what their enemy would do, which... I'm not Sun Tzu, I'm not Julius Caesar, much to everyone's disappointment, I'm sure. But they thought they had the measure of their enemy, and they didn't. And even when their enemy was nobody at all.
I've been thinking about this a lot. So I've got three examples, but I think I know which one I'm going to... I've got one that's related to that. It's almost... I was worried it might be a similar situation, but I think this is better. But I'll tell you the two I've rejected first. First is the invasion of Sealand. The 1978 invasion of Sealand. Are you aware of Sealand?
Vaguely.
It's where they keep the whales, isn't it? Shamu. No. Shamu was a leading general in the invasion of Sealand, I think.
Yeah, that's what Star Trek 4 is about. So that's a very nerdy joke. No, Sealand is about 6 miles off the coast of Norfolk. It's a Second World War naval fort.
Oh yeah, it's the big concrete thing, isn't it?
Yeah, two concrete towers on a platform, right? It used to be called the Rough Towers. There's actually two invasions of Sealand. It was abandoned after the war. There was no need for it anymore, and it literally is just outside of British waters. Actually, now it's just inside British waters. Then it was just outside British waters, there was no British use for it. It was being used by pirate radio, for pirate radio in the 60s. In 1965, it was invaded by a guy called Roy Bates.
That demeans the word invasion when you say it was invaded by a man, and this is his boring name.
And his son Michael. and a few of their mates, they invaded it, kicked off the pirate radios. They were going to decide to set their own pirate radio station, but at that point, the rules around pirate radio stations changed, and it became a lot more illegal to do it. So they decided instead they were just going to declare this platform their own country, call it Sealand, and Roy Bates declared himself the Prince of Sealand.
It's a micronation.
Crown Prince. Sorry?
It's a micronation, isn't it?
It's a micronation, yeah. The island principality of Sealand. And Roy Bates became the Prince of Sealand. His son became the Crown Prince of Sealand. Now, that's not the invasion I'm talking about, right? That was actually a successful invasion. It went pretty well. The better one is, by 1975, Sealand has passports, it has a national anthem, it has a football team, it had a flag. You could buy lordships for Sealand. You could buy you still can. You can go online and buy your dad a thing saying he's officially now an Earl of Sealand and stuff. This bonkers thing is still there, although it's now much more boring. But the interesting thing, the thing I liked, happened in 1978 when the Prime Minister of Sealand got into a fight with the Prince of Sealand about what they wanted to do with it. The Prime Minister wanted to turn it into a luxury hotel, and Prince Roy Bates was like, no, this is our country, our home. So the Prime Minister, whose name I now can't remember because it was a complicated German name, and I'm an ignorant xenophobe, persuaded the prince and his wife, the princess, to leave to go to Austria. I think it was Austria. And they would basically they went on false pretenses to go to a business meeting that never happened. While they were there, the Prime Minister, using a team of German and Dutch mercenaries, invaded Sealand with a helicopter, speedboats, machine guns and jet skis.
Wow.
A Bond film.
I cannot imagine any 1970s mercenaries thought they were going to be getting work in the North Sea.
But it gets better because the Bates family fought back. They hired their own mercenaries. They got their own speedboats and jet skis and their own helicopter, piloted by a guy who'd done stunt helicopter work in the James Bond franchise. And they retook the island of Sealand and took everyone hostage and held them to ransom for quite a lot of money. And the Bates family still technically are the royal family of Sealand. Roy Bates is dead now, so the Crown Prince is now the Prince of Sealand, although he's very elderly too. They don't even live there anymore, and it's now used as a server farm. But as an addendum to this story, the Pirate Bay tried to buy Sealand about 10 years ago when it became impossible for them to legally let people run their servers. So they tried to buy Sealand because they thought it was very appropriate, but they wouldn't sell it to them.
I've just looked up Sealand. Apparently they have a claimed GDP of $600,000, which presumably is their fee for whatever servers they're hosting.
Yeah, that would be it. Which they're hosting because of America's strict rules as well. They've been used as a tax loophole loads of times for people.
Their flag is very disappointing. Their flag is very. It's just like a red triangle, orange, white stripe, black triangle.
And most of the members of the Sealand football team over the years actually lived in Norfolk. So, but that's not unusual in sport, as I've led to believe.
No. They're not. They don't have to be from the country.
Your satirical joke about Chelsea there, or whoever football team.
Yeah, or you know, Tony Cascarino only ended up playing for Ireland because his Sealander granny told him, no, go with your Irish granny's heritage.
So that's my first failed thing. That was okay, but I thought we could go juicier. So the next one I thought about is the Battle of Jingxing, which is in 205 BC, which has got a brilliant Pratchett link, because I'm fairly sure, though I can't prove it, but I'm fairly sure that it's the inspiration for parts of the book Interesting Times. So
yes, I think you're right.
So this is there's about a military genius, Han Xin, who successfully managed to defeat 200,000 strong Zhao army, the land of Zhao. I know nothing about ancient Chinese landscapes, but the Hans and the Zhaos were at war, and the Han army numbered 30,000. The Zhao army numbered 200,000. Now, the Han army, under the leadership of the general Han Xin, who was pretty much unknown at the time, he was kind of an unknown quantity, was ordered to invade Zan. This is the worst invasion, because it's more of worst invasion defense, because it's a successful invasion based on the stupidity of the opponent. I can't for the life of me work out why this invasion was ordered, because the odds were massively stacked against them. But this guy just went, okay, I'm up for the challenge, and took what is basically, I believe, in a technical term called a big swing. So what he did, he attacks the land of Zhao, gets to the banks of a river, and then beds in with the river behind him. Sets up fortifications along the riverbank, but the opposing army is in front of him. So basically what they did is deliberately cut off their own means to escape. This guy's theory was that his men would fight harder because they had no choice. Then he ordered them to wave flags and make noise and basically shout, come and have a go if you think you're harder. At the army, five times bigger than his army. The Zhao army committed most of their forces, just like, okay, fuck it, we're going to attack them, went for them. These guys did fight like tigers. They fought like maniacs because they had no choice, and also their fortifications were very good. So it suddenly became clear that they were going to be bedded in. Like, they definitely lose, but they're going to be bedded in for a while. So the Zhao army retreated slightly to regroup and have a rethink. Now, what had happened in the meantime is the night before, Han Xin had sent 2,000 troops around the back of the army on a march, armed pretty much only with a load of battle flags. And as soon as the army had advanced on the river fortification, they'd gone into the camp, killed loads of people because there was hardly anyone left there, and then set up all of these flags in the camp. So when the retreating, regrouping Zhao army turned round, they thought, oh shit, there is another massive army with all of these flags behind us. Panic ensued. People started deserting. They started running. They lost complete discipline, just evaporated, at which point the Han Xin unleashed his forces from their riverbank defences in a pincer movement, got them on either side, and slaughtered most of the men.
Wow. I'd like to imagine they also, like the guys who took that camp and put up the flags, they also had like a sock puppet on each hand to make it look like there was three times as many of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
This led to an old Asian saying about fighting with your back to the river. That's where that came from.
Oh, cool.
He's fighting with his back to the river. It didn't quite count. It is a bad invasion from the invaders' point of view. From the invadees.
Yes.
So that was my second one. But I think the one I'm going to go for, the one I think is the best, worst invasion, is the Austrian invasion of the Austrian Empire. Which is one of my absolute favorites. So the Holy Roman Empire were involved in a war with the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, right? Now, at this point, the Holy Roman Empire was massive, a lot of Eastern Europe was part of the Holy Roman Empire, the Austrian Empire. So the army is chasing the Turkish army. They're trying to track them down, going through their own country in Transylvania, actually. So there's a 100,000 strong army moving towards the Turkish army, trying to find them, trying to outflank them, trying to work out where they are. So they do this forced overnight march that ends in the Transylvanian town of Caransebeș. This is the Battle of Caransebeș. So what happened is there'd been a forced march, everyone was knackered, so they bedded in, most people went to bed, but they sent the vanguard, the cavalry, over the river to try and find out, to try to scout the area. Now, the cavalry didn't find the Turkish army. What they found was a Romani settlement, and the Romanis went, okay, there's an army on our doorstep, what do we do? Let's sell them some booze. And they sold the schnapps. They sold the Austrian cavalry schnapps, loads of schnapps, and the Austrian cavalry proceeded to get absolutely hammered. Now, what happened a little while later is the infantry turned up. A small infantry platoon was also sent, but obviously the cavalry got there ahead because they're on horses. The infantry turn up, where are our drinks? We don't have any more drinks for you. There are our drinks, you're not having them. They started having an argument between the cavalry and the infantry, because obviously infantry and cavalry don't get on very well. Cavalry tend to be posher, better educated. Infantrymen are the lowest of the low. They're the foot soldiers, literally. So the pissed cavalry soldiers got, you're not having our booze. And they started digging in and putting up fortifications, presumably just for a laugh. They started arguing. Eventually, somebody gets shot. and then suddenly they start going at each other, the cavalry and the infantry. And at some point during this, somebody started shouting, "Turks, Turks." everyone's convinced that the Turks are attacking. Not helped by, apparently, and I don't know how this works, this is an army of many, many different nationalities. It's an imperial army. And a lot of them didn't really understand each other. And people were shouting the German for halt, which was apparently halt mal, which people thought sounded like Allah. I don't really know why. I'm not sure, but they were convinced that the Turkish army were about to attack. Wow. So what happened is the cavalry fucked off. They immediately turned tail, ran back to the rest of the army. Now what happened then is the rest of the army just see cavalry troops going towards them and open fire. So you have the Austrian army opening fire on the Austrian cavalry. What happens then is the rest of the army wakes up, doesn't know what the fuck is going on, and they just start fighting anybody, no discipline, just fighting it, shooting anything that moves. Eventually, the entire army is ordered to retreat, as it turns out, from itself. And eventually they worked out what was happening. And about 2 days later, the real Turkish army arrived. And everyone was already dead. Leaving only a small amount of people to defend the town, and the Turks were able to withstand the attack. And the Austrians managed to unsuccessfully invade their own territory. Now, there's a caveat to this in that the historian who wrote most about it isn't 100% reliable. So it's one of those things where no one is entirely sure of the facts, and it could have been blown out of proportion, but I like to think it hadn't. There are some estimates that 10,000 people died. Other estimates put it as low as 150. You know, decide which trouser leg of time you would like to live in.
I began by looking at pitch invasions in sport, and all sorts of beasts have invaded pitches. Obviously, famously, dogs skipping around the outskirts, cows, ducks, even in Australia, a kangaroo. But my favourite animal gatecrasher was in 2013, back in Switzerland, in a match between FC Thun and FC Zurich, a pine marten appeared on the pitch and scuttled along. And you know, pine martens, like weasels, scuttle in that sort of U-shape sometimes. So they went on there. It took 5 minutes to get rid of it. And in that 5 minutes, it managed to bite defender Loris Benito. And the Pine Martin got a yellow card for unsportsmanlike behaviour. And in the end, it was left to the Zurich keeper, David Acosta, to pick it up because he was wearing a pair of gloves. And he launched it into the opponent's penalty box, where it caught his striker offside.
You've just mentioned animals on Twitter. Do you know who Rufus is, who works at Wimbledon?
Rufus is the kestrel, or the hawk who takes out the pigeons.
They've a Harris hawk who patrols Wimbledon to keep the pigeons away from it. Who is described? Rufus is described as an important member of the Wimbledon family, having taken over from Hamish about 15 years ago, and he patrols during the daily visits during the 2 weeks of the Wimbledon Championships. And
well, of course, the problem with Hamish is that when he failed to catch the pigeons, he was a Scottish hawk rather than a British one.
Yes, almost certainly. But in June 2012, Rufus was stolen from the back of his owner's car. Yeah. Usually he'd be driven back to Corby in Northamptonshire, but the owner had chosen to stay in London, and the theft apparently caused a global outcry, making Rufus the world's most notable bird. He was found 3 days later on Wimbledon Common, handed into the RSPCA, healthy, with only a small injury being a sore leg. And, yeah, there you go. He apparently was the victim of a kidnap. He also has an account on Twitter.
Anything interesting?
Oh, let's have a look. I haven't actually looked that up. I just read that now.
I didn't know that hawks went tweet. That's amazing.
That was congratulations, Mark, on the finest open goal in quite a while.
Rufus's last tweet was a reply to a tweet on May 16th. How is Rufus the Hawk coping? He's at Rufus the Hawk, if anyone wants to follow him. How is at Rufus the Hawk coping with COVID-19, taking a sabbatical? Rufus replied, I'm staying well, thank you. Keeping to the skies. I hope you're staying well too. Cloud emoji.
Oh, that's incredibly formal and polite for a hawk.
I am going to follow it with the Worst Foot Forward account immediately.
Right, let's see if we can get the Hawkmaster, Wimbledon's Hawkmaster General, onto Worst Foot Forward.
Apparently he has a Wimbledon security pass with the top job title of Bird Scarer on it.
Perfect. Good. Well, that's the extra content for Patreon sorted for June. Well done, Barry. Other pitch invasions. AEK Athens are Athens' most famous football club, but their sworn enemies are PAOK Athens. And in 2018, the president of PAOK invaded the pitch and sent other players scuttling to the tunnel when he stormed to it to protest a late disallowed goal wearing a holstered pistol. He didn't just automatically forfeit the match for getting out the gun and waving it around. The side were docked 3 points, the national team was threatened with a ban by FIFA, and the Greek Super League was suspended for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that you expect in sort of like the Paraguayan League, with the greatest of love to Paraguay. I sort of expect sort of gun-toting presidential maniacs over there. And the one other pitch invasion I want to talk about is back in Switzerland again. In 2010, fans of FC Basel were so enraged that the national TV network moved their kickoff time to accommodate a Roger Federer match that they threw enough tennis balls onto the pitch to suspend play for 40 minutes.
Imagine Federer there trying to return 40,000 tennis balls as well. Yeah. But that's 2010, he probably was nippy enough back then.
But I looked, like you guys, back at military stuff. First of all, the CIA, this isn't technically an invasion in the conventional sense, but in 2005 and 2006, the CIA began a psychological warfare program known as Devil Eyes. And what they did is they developed and distributed an Osama bin Laden action figure throughout South Asia in conjunction with the toy maker Donald Levine, who formerly worked for Hasbro. And he was being credited as the father of G.I. Joe. He designed this 12-inch lifelike figure of bin Laden, whose face was painted with a material that, when heated, would peel off to reveal a demon-like visage with red skin, green eyes, and black markings. The goal of the program was to scare children and their parents in an effort to turn public opinion against bin Laden. The CIA acknowledged the existence of the program, but said it was discontinued after Levine produced only 3 prototype figurines. But an anonymous source suggested that there were hundreds of toys created and shipped out to Karachi in 2006. Guys, we need to find those and take them to a comic book convention. If it is still in the box, it is worth hundreds of thousands of pounds.
That's amazing. Also, you could use it to reenact one of the scenes at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
in between World War One and World War Two, there were various little skirmishes that the newly minted League of Nations had to deal with. My favourite of them, though, is in 1925, the incident at Petrich, or as it's more commonly known, the War of the Stray Dog. And this was part of the ongoing Greek-Bulgarian crisis. And what happened was Bulgarian forces shot and killed a Greek soldier who was later found to have crossed into enemy territory whilst chasing his pet dog. And Greek officials demanded compensation, but tensions kept rising and rising and rising. And because there'd been border skirmishes for decades beforehand, and it almost resulted in a full-blown war between the two of them because of the long-standing, I'm going to say beef, because I'm not an international diplomat, between the two. Bulgaria refused to pay any form of compensation, and so the Greek forces launched an invasion against the town of Petrich to punish the soldiers responsible for the murder. However, locals formed a militia and so they could defend their homes against the Greek incursion, and it was... By the time the League of Nations had intervened, 50 people had died, and the Greeks had to end up paying a reverse compensation for this. So, their overreaction cost them $45,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
But first of all, but you don't hear the story about the mouse that was chased by a stray cat, that was chased by the stray dog, that was chased by the soldier, who was then chased by the army.
Now, before I get to my selection, I'm going to say something that's... It's not strictly an invasion, it's a land dispute between India and Bangladesh. But Mark, or... Well, maybe you too, Barry, I don't know how well-versed you are in Pratchett lore. Tell me if this reminds you of any book. For a good 40 years... There has been a dispute between Bangladesh and India for an island called New Mur or South Talpati Island. Can you tell me how you think this dispute was settled? And if you can, what Pratchett book it may relate to?
How closely does the dispute, the settlement of the dispute, relate to the Pratchett book?
It's very close to a resolution.
So, did the island in question sink, thus removing the source of the conflict?
Correct, that's right. So it is just like in Jingo. So the island emerged in 1970 after a cyclone, and it was rich in oil and natural gas. But yeah, it then disappeared in 2010 again, just being submerged again, sunk underneath the sea. I'd love to know if that or something else like it was an inspiration for it. If you've not read the book, I'd say the island is very much the MacGuffin of the book. We're giving nothing away. But it is basically a hollowed out limestone island that just pops up in the middle of the Circle Sea between Ankh-Morpork and the Klatchian Empire, and then just pops up and down every few hundred years.
So when did it emerge?
It emerged in 1970.
Okay, so all right, that's possible. It's exactly the kind of arcane thing that Pratchett would have known.
Yeah, it would have been. And that is, I'm torn. It's a toss-up between that and Small Gods for me as my favourite Pratchett book. But that is, that for me is him being his most perceptive on race. And I think the characters of Vimes and Vetinari, who are my two favourites, are at their peak in that book.
What's the book called?
Jingo,
excellent. Yeah, you've reminded me of, I'm sure I've talked about on the show before, A Beer to Will, which is the area of land between Egypt and Sudan, which neither country wants to claim because it would mean giving up a larger portion of land. So because it's this tiny little bit trapped between two countries, it doesn't have any border with anyone else. It's the largest piece of sort of unwanted land, for want of a better word, on planet Earth.
You know, it's very possible that that's an inspiration for a Discworld novel as well, because that sounds like the land of the Jelly Baby, which is less funny when you say it out loud than when you see it written down and don't realise it's a joke for a while. But that's in the book Pyramids, which is a book about a small river nation that is between two giant desert empires, and it's basically the thing that stops the two of them from going to war because of its existence.
It sounds pretty much bang on. Yeah, it was when the British redrew the borders between Egypt and Sudan, they went, this bit of land should probably be in Egypt, actually, and this bit of land should be down in Sudan. But whichever, accepting the Beer to Will meant giving away a bit of land that they'd rather have kept instead. So neither country wants it. There's been various, you know, white American families shown up with their princess, with their daughters saying, of course you can be a princess, darling. You can be Princess of Beer to Will, and I've made you a flag for it. Which you can read about if you want to go researching Beer to Will.
Yeah, does anything ever happen there, or is it just like a void in space?
It's largely desert with a few Bedouins in it. That's kind of all there is to it.
Just a few Bedouins going, anyone want to rule us? Anyone? Nope. All right, we'll carry on as we were. Well, my invasion, gentlemen, and my choice for the worst invasion is the last attempt to invade the British Isles. Any thoughts on when this might be and where it might be and who might be the major players?
I'm going to assume that the Second World War is too obvious. The Falklands, actually, during the Falklands conflicts, Argentina did attempt to buy Sealand in order to have their own footing right on Britain's doorstep, but the royal family wouldn't sell it to them.
That's gloriously petty. I once massively lost an audience in rural Lincolnshire when there was a woman in from the Falkland Islands who was lovely, and I made a very polite joke of, you know, maybe since it's 8,000 miles away, we should give it back. She found it funny. The room full of the middlest of Middle England did not like that. Not least since it turns out quite a lot of RAF bases are in the flat part of Lincolnshire there. And literally, because she said she went, I'm pretty certain she said that she went there because she went there on a holiday, fell in love, and then moved there. And I came back on in the second section and I spoke to a guy and I went, and he said, oh yeah, I've been to the Falklands as well. I was like, what, you were there on holiday as well? And he was like, no mate, I served there. And then my interval Googling, I went, actually guys, I've done a little bit of a look at it, and it turns out that the Falklands are actually closer to Chile than they are to Argentina, so I think you guys should give it back to Chile. And again, it's a rare treat to lose a room twice in a night.
How about during one of the Cod Wars?
When were the Cod Wars?
Oh, the 60s and 70s. Iceland. Did Iceland show up on the Shetlands or something like that?
Nope, way before that.
Oh, much earlier. So, and we're not counting World War II because it wasn't a proper invasion then?
Well, because it wasn't a land... it wasn't a land invasion. All the Germans managed was the Battle of Britain.
Okay.
Operation Sea Lion was going to be the...
That was the name of it.
It was cancelled, but it was cancelled at the last minute because Hitler decided to concentrate on the Blitz instead. Not knowing how badly he decimated the RAF, and had he proceeded with Operation Sea Lion at that point, he probably would have successfully invaded the country.
Yeah, well, and also the training was just an absolute mess because he was just getting hundreds of thousands of Wehrmacht soldiers to practice balancing a beach ball on their nose.
give us a year and see if we can guess a bit more.
1797.
Oh, is it the French not showing up for the Irish?
It's one of the occasions that the French fucked it for the Irish. It is the Battle of Fishguard. Which is, if you're British and want to know, Fishguard is the end of the M4. If you leave London and aim for Bristol and then eventually get to Cardiff and you keep driving for about 3 years, you end up at the very end of the M4 where you can almost but not quite see Ireland on a clear day.
It's a ferry port. I've been there. It's a very, very much a ferry port, and that's kind of all there is there.
Yeah, I've done a gig there where there was 100 taffies who were delighted to see me with the look of, my God, you came all the way from London. What is the future like? Here was the plan. Napoleon was busy conquering all of Europe, and in his absence, the French revolutionary government, the Directoire, I think they were called, devised a plan that involved trying to rally the people of Wales and Ireland to support the French as their liberators. And his plan was that two forces would land in Britain as a diversionary effort, whilst the main body would land in Ireland, which of course at that point belonged to the British. However, two forces were halted by bad weather, and the third aimed at landing in Wales and then marching on Bristol. However, it all went a little bit wrong. Let me tell you about the Wales-bound invasion force, because they were 1,400 troops known as La Légion Noire, because most of them were made up of members of a penal battalion. And they were under the command of the Irish-American Colonel William Tate, who had a grudge against the British because members of his family had been killed in the Revolutionary War. He sounds fascinating because from a lot of sources, it's claimed that he is, at this point, over 70. So he's a doddery pensioner with a score to settle with the British.
But also a doddery American-Irishman in charge of the French.
Yeah. So, on Wednesday, February the 22nd, the French warship sailed into Fishguard Bay and they were greeted by cannon fire from the local fort. What they didn't realise is that that cannon was being fired as an alarm to the local townsfolk. However, as soon as they heard that one cannon fire, the ships withdrew and then sailed on until they reached a small sandy beach near the village of Llandwyndar.
Any Welsh
speakers, feel free to tell me where the consonants should be there. They unloaded, and thus the last invasion of Britain by land began. The ships returned to France, with a special despatch being sent straight to Paris to tell them about the successful landing. However, as soon as they landed, the Légion Noire lost discipline. They immediately headed to a cache of rich food and wine that the locals had recently removed from a grounded Portuguese ship. They looted it and got absolutely hammered, and within 2 days they were too drunk to fight.
And
so many of these stories are, and then the army got drunk and disaster ensues.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, on February the 25th, Tate's forces surrendered to a local militia force led by Lord Cawdor. My favourite part of it all, though, is that in the surrender agreement, Tate's officers referred to the British coming at them with thousands of troops lining up. There were no such troops anywhere near Fishguard. What probably happened is that hundreds of local Welsh women dressed in their traditional scarlet tunics and felt black hats came to witness what was going on, and he mistook them for redcoats.
Or they were so drunk they were seeing double, treble, quadruple.
Yeah. And one final note should be about a legendary local heroine, Jemima Nicholas, who was reported to have tricked French invaders into surrendering. It's suggested that she might have taken advantage of this misunderstanding of them being redcoats, and it's claimed that she single-handedly captured 12 French soldiers and escorted them to town, where she locked them in St. Mary's Church, and there is plaques commemorating that, and it's suggested that she did it whilst brandishing a trident. So, for me, this invasion has got everything. It has got drunken prisoners, French incompetence, and surprising Welsh heroes. And that is why the Battle of Fishguard is my suggestion for the world's worst invasion. Our suggestions this week for the world's worst invasion are Barry's of the invasion of an unoccupied island by the Japanese and the invasion of Kiska, Mark's brilliant suggestion of the Austrian invasion of the Austrian Empire, and mine is of the ill-fated, undermanned, woozily drunken Battle of Fishguard. Gentlemen, an excellent serving. I'm going to dismiss Barry's straight away. I like it. I do, but there seems like an awful lot of procedural doings in the telling of the story. Yeah, I do like the idea of an unoccupied island. Mark, any of your three could go for it. They really could. They were superb. I was delighted by Sealand. And I'm finding it tough. I'm finding it tough between the two of us because I like quite how badly wrong the Battle of Fishguard went. And the jingoistic side of me really wants to giggle at the French fucking up. But I think both of ours have
the level of glorious incompetence and booze involved in both, which is quite
appealing.
There is. That's what's making it so difficult to decide. But I think the difference is that the French did invade where they meant to invade. Whereas because the Austrians accidentally invaded themselves, there's a beautiful sort of Ouroboros feel to that.
Takes some doing.
Yeah, it really does. And that strikes the right note for this podcast. And, I mean, I hate to bang the drum, but does seem a little bit Pratchettian.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does. A little bit of a couple of different bits in Pratchett mm-hmm. books where war turns up. And, like, yeah, there's something of a monstrous regiment in that kind of kind of fiasco of an army falling apart, and Jingo as well. But I don't think he's ever specifically referenced.
No, he hasn't. Well, also, one of my favourite things that I read in a book of his, or an interview, is he gleefully deletes first drafts with a cry of, bad luck, literary historians, get a proper job.
See, that's not even true.
No.
what he did is he took the first draft and then he just carried on writing it and rewrote it because it's a word processor and there was no need to maintain the first draft. So his first draft is also the last draft, which has been continually evolving over time.
Oh, wow. But were you able to see any of those drafts?
He claimed he never bothered to, you know, he'd do like a first draft for himself that no one would ever see. And then he'd basically just rewrite it. And so the first draft that anyone saw, it would have been rewritten so many times. It could barely be considered a first draft.
Huh. Because I know that by the time he got to his later novels, he had an amazing sort of like multi-screen computer display.
Yeah, he always had as many screens as a computer could drive. If you see videos of him in the 90s, he had two monitors, which was unheard of in the 90s. By the late 2000s, he had six. And when people asked him why he had six monitors, he'd say, it's because I can't get it to do seven.
Good.
In many ways, if Terry Pratchett was still alive, he'd probably be streaming on Twitch, wouldn't he?
don't indulge him. Don't indulge him. Before we go, it's time for the world's best news, and I would like to tell you some lovely news. Do you remember back at the start of the year, before it all got really bad, there was massive forest fires in Australia. Stay with me.
God, I can't remember that far back, Ben.
Yeah.
There have been 17 volumes of history written since that.
Well, I want to tell you about a remarkable dog called Bear. Bear the dog. And obviously that's because he's called Bear the dog because he's keeping him going, oh, I've got Bear with me. But he is one of many koala detection dogs. And Bear goes out into the smouldering remains of the forest and finds injured koalas. And helps Australian vets bring them back and rescue them and nurse them back to health. And recently, Bear has struck up his century, like all good Australians, and he has rescued his 100th koala.
Such a good boy.
Such a good boy. There's a lovely picture of him wearing special little bear socks, special little dog socks, so that he doesn't burn his feet on the smouldering forest.
Ben, what? I've not even saved one koala. What am I doing with my life?
Yeah, you've been outshone by an Australian dog.
Not for the first time.
Before we go, Mark, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Twitter is the best place to find me because I live there. I mean, I work there, literally. I work at Twitter. That's my day job. But I'm basically on Twitter all the time spouting nonsense. So that's probably the best place to find me. At 20th Century Mark, it's Mark with a CT. So it's 20THCENTUR, however you spell 20th century, and then MARC. That's where you can mostly find me, mostly talking about my book. And also spouting lefty nonsense, talking about forgotten indie bands and stupid knob jokes.
The book is out in July, isn't it?
July 30th.
Very good. It's available for pre-orders now if people want to.
Yeah, you can buy it now from, I set up a website for it called askmeaboutterrypratchett.com. Because I'd rather you bought it. I bought a shitload of them from the publisher. I'd rather you bought it from me than bought it off Amazon. Ask me about terrypratchett.com, and I've got there's loads of special editions and stuff you can get.
Oh, I got it. That's a reference to Stanley from Going Postal.
Yes. Ask me about pins. You're absolutely right.
Oh, love it. Do you have any? What's your favourite esoteric Pratchett fact to tease us into reading the book?
There's the time. Not many people know when Pratchett was a journalist, he interviewed Roald Dahl in 1968, when Roald Dahl wasn't very famous. He'd mostly famous for writing short stories, and he'd written Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach at that point, but neither had been massive, massive hits yet. They were just, he went and interviewed him about his latest collection of short stories, and they had a lovely conversation. The interview is really good. It's very difficult to track down. It's never been put online, and it's not under Pratchett's byline. So I only found it because I knew the byline he was writing under. He wrote under the pseudonym Marcus for when he was writing features for this newspaper. And I was just flicking through it, looking at Marcus articles, and came across an interview with Roald Dahl, which the Roald Dahl website claims they never knew if it existed or not. All they had was a letter from him asking for an interview, and they never knew if it took place. It did take place, and in it, it includes the glorious comment, which absolutely sums up the level of fame that Roald Dahl had at the time. Roald Dahl, perhaps best known to British audiences as the husband of actress Patricia... Oh, what was her surname? Patricia Neal. Best known as the husband of actress Patricia Neal.
Wow. I thought you were going to say best known as the husband of Patricia Routledge. Which would be a hell of a turn. Cool.
Dahl, it turns out, the Amal Clooney of his time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff you won't know in that because I found a lot of things out. You know, the time he fainted trying to have a go at his boss, the time he was chasing radioactive swans, the piano tie he wore to fate important meetings. There's why he called Neil Gaiman a bastard. There's loads of stuff to find. The mysterious and complicated movie rights of the movie to Mort that nearly became a Disney classic but then didn't happen. There's loads of stuff that people just don't know.
Cool. Oh, I really look forward to reading it, buddy, and I hope it sells extraordinarily well. And listen, we've got no else to do in these lockdown times other than to read a shed load of books, so listeners, go out and buy Mark's fabulous biography of Terry Pratchett. In the meantime, we're all off to get hammered and try and invade Camden Town. Until next time, we'll see you later. Bye-bye.